Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Susan Kalman, and welcome back to Susan Kalman's Mrs. Brightside. It's Series 2. Thanks for downloading the show.
My parents came to my Soho show. They came to see my show last year, entirely about my dad and our relationship and my mental health and expressing that and my sexuality to them. And they had a really nice time and think Soho Theatre is lovely.
Last year I spoke to 8 people about their tricksy mental health, and this year I'll be chatting to 8 more.
He would be like, great night, great night had by all, but we didn't talk about the show. We just said, what a wonderful place. And we all moved on.
I'm doing this because I want people to be more open about their mental health, and I know sometimes it can be difficult to define what that means. So we're going to be having a frank and open discussion, no parameters, no written questions, no definitions, and no pop psychology.
And I've got a list of people. Mm-hmm. Do you have a list of people?
A list of enemies, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure I do.
It's important for you to know that these are not therapy sessions. I am not a qualified psychiatrist, no matter how much Casualty I've watched. They're just honest conversations about what we think and feel about our own heads. This week, I spoke to Catherine Bohart, a comedian who articulately explained her own mental health issues and who called me a psychopath.
My point is always this. You want me as your neighbour. You shouldn't be frightened of having 2 lesbians living next door to you. We are brilliant.
Agreed.
We take care of our house. We'll take your bins down for you. In fact, there's a fight for it. You want us.
Yeah.
I keep a notebook with everyone's number plates that come into the street in case there's a robbery.
Oh my God, you are a psychopath.
It was a great chat.
Recently been recording a travel show for Channel 5 called Secret Scotland Series 2. Series 1 was very successful.
I'll pretend to be surprised, but I follow you on Twitter.
And I said to them, I don't care what we do, just make sure there's a toilet, because I'm obsessed. If you've listened to Series 1 of Mrs. Brightside, you'll know that I have a severe issue regarding the accessibility of toilets.
Reasonable.
I need to know there is one nearby. And they said, yes, yes, of course, of course, of course. Now, of course, they lied, because it's television.
Yeah. Don't believe a word they say.
So I had to sea kayak out to a lighthouse. And I said at that point, that this was 3 hours after we'd started. I'd been to the toilet. 3 hours later, I said, where's the toilet? And the lighthouse man said, there's no toilet. And I'd always said if I had to pee outside, I mean, that's my line.
Yeah.
And I was peeing on an island beside a lighthouse, and I thought, this is truly horrific.
I have a question.
Yes.
How long are the lighthouse man's shift?
Well, it's an unmanned lighthouse. They change the light bulb.
I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, they change the light bulb once a year, and I was being allowed to change the light bulb, which is a big honour. But they didn't have a toilet.
Is it a big honour if you have to wee outside? It is not slightly tarnished.
And then it was 5 hours later of filming. I said, I really need the toilet. And the director said, well, you could just go behind the bush. Now, I was on a beach in a place called Arran in Scotland, and everyone had their phones out already because I'm that nice lady from the telly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, someone's going to film me.
Yep.
And that is going to be, you know, that's not... Anyway.
100%.
Welcome to Mrs. Brightside.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
A lot of listeners to this podcast have toilet-related anxiety. So
that's
we've just hit it.
I think my equivalent, I don't have as much of a toilet-based anxiety because I have OCD and I am well trained at not going to the toilet for very many hours so as to avoid going to public toilets, which I can now do. Big move for me, but it was spent a lot of my time not being able
to. Okay, hold on a second.
Sorry, yes.
Shall we start? I always ask people, because you've now listened, we're five minutes in and nobody knows who you are.
Yeah.
So what I always like to do...
Because my career is going really well.
You don't need anyone to know who you are. I always like to get the person I'm talking to introduce themselves and say what they do.
Yes.
So it's not one of those, I've decided what you do. So please say your name and what you think you do.
Okay. Hello, I'm Catherine Bohart. I think I mainly sit around in my pyjamas, but other than that, sometimes I do comedy. I'm a comedian.
You are. You're a very good comedian.
Thank you for saying that.
No, I have been a great admirer of yours for some time.
Thank you.
And it is very exciting for me to be...
Well, I'm a big fan of yours, so that makes me feel uncomfortable and a bit like you took my line. I'm not going to lie to you, Susan. I've been in WhatsApp groups about whether or not your wife's face was adorable or very, very adorable during Strictly.
That is concerning.
Was the Facebook group just my sister and I? Yes, it was. But boy, were we fans, and did we like to watch her watch you dance.
She was. She put up with a lot, I'll tell you that.
I think she was endearing as all hell. You're also very good. Well done on the dancing. Yes. But my God, do we like to watch your face.
It's always very disappointing whenever I turn up somewhere without her. People go, oh, is Lee not here? And you go, no, I am. Yeah. Oh, no, you didn't want me.
Well, it's just better if there's both. You know, I mean, I have the exact same thing with my girlfriend's also a comic. And yeah, people do that thing where they go, oh my God, Sarah's so good at comedy. And I, yes, thank you. Yes, indeed, I have also met her.
So this, we've touched on it already.
Sorry, yes.
No, never apologise.
I mean, I cannot promise that.
I have a huge thing. I always say, especially to women, working on that show, there were a couple of female runners and they would apologise before they spoke to me. And I said, have you done something wrong?
Yeah.
Why are you apologising?
Oh, I should say, I have committed many crimes. This is just the place I finally feel comfortable apologising. I've never said sorry before. I just wanted to let you know I am sorry.
You do know this is admissible in court, just
to
let you know.
Okay, crimes. Yeah. I mean, it might be hyperbolic.
This is a kind of about mental health and all that stuff. I suffer from depression and anxiety because I'm a lucky lady. What's your particular mental health problem?
Congratulations on your combo. Well
Thank
done for
you.
Saying it out loud.
Very
it's
much.
Really awkward. I know that. I have obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, it was because I'd gotten to a point of clinical depression. Because if you have an undiagnosed illness, you will often find yourself depressed on account of the confusion and the obsessions. More to the point, some of my obsessive compulsive disorder also tends towards BDD, so body dysmorphic disorder, but predominantly I have obsessive compulsive disorder, but fortunately for me, it's pretty much under control.
People talk about OCD as if it's one thing.
Yes.
But it's not, is it? There are lots of different types of OCD.
As far as I understand it, there are 7 clinical types, but there are probably more.
How does your OCD manifest itself?
So I have a type of OCD which is called, and I'm aware how ridiculous it sounds, perfectionism. Yes, I'm just a really great gal. I just have standards, guys. No, but the thing is, the problem is I have what I suppose people think they know of OCD, which is an obsession with tidiness, order, symmetry, perfection. But it's not like I just love things being tidy. It's more that I can't think about, for example, I'm fine and we should leave it there. But there is a highlighter on the floor, inexplicably, in this room. I mean, aside from that, the chairs are all over the place and I don't know who designed the room, but they clearly hate me. So I would be incapable of thinking about anything other than the order of a space that I was in specifically, and especially spaces that I owned or felt like I could have control over. But basically, anything being in disarray was not just like, oh, I wish this was tidy, but exceptionally upsetting for me to the point of extreme anxiety. And that meant that in order to engage with those obsessive thoughts and ruminations, I would then engage in behaviours like tidying and cleaning for hours and hours and hours to the detriment of my, you know, life.
Mm-hmm.
And stop me if you have any questions or if this is incredibly dull.
No. Nope.
Which is effectively me apologising without saying sorry. And I got to a really bad place with it and was quite bad at being able to go outside. Like I said, I couldn't do things like go to the go to public toilets, except for when I went to Florida and they have little like tissue things you put on the seat.
On the seats, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. How exciting were they? I mean, I think I was the only kid at Disneyland who was like, has everyone seen the toilet seat covers? People were like, you're 16, you're supposed to be having a good time.
Let me talk to you about that, because I mean, I don't have diagnosed OCD in the slightest. I have, I think in mental health, there's shades of things if we're lucky. So I have a real toilet issue, not just the availability of the cleanliness.
They're disgusting, sure.
Yeah. And I insist on having, I've never told anyone this before, but I feel we can share. I insist on having blue in the toilet. You know, the thing. Like, I have to have it in the toilet.
Of course.
And
well, otherwise you're just sitting on a germ vacuum, I understand.
And it's the colour as well. I need to look clean. Mm-hmm. It ran out and my wife got the lemon and didn't understand why I was so upset. And it's because, and I clean the bathroom a lot, and public toilets are quite difficult. Mm-hmm. Now, when I go in, I just feel quite sick. And it just makes me so anxious.
Yeah.
In terms of people listening to this, what's always useful is trying to describe how it makes you feel in that. Why are they so kind of terrifying and awkward and horrible, the public toilets?
So I should say, now I can use them and I'm fine. It is sometimes hard. There are some where the standards are too low where I can't. I have a very kind partner who will do things like go to the toilet before me in the airplane so that I know I'm following her. And that's a good friend and a good person. But I think it's about control, right? It's about things being, I have no idea who was there. I have no idea what it's going to look like. I don't want to see dirt. I don't want to have anybody else's dirt on me. That's a big like thing. But with OCD, usually there's a fear, right, an irrational fear, for example, that if I go to a public toilet and I touch the toilet, then I will have hundreds of people's filth on me and that I won't be able to wash it off. That was my irrational fear. Now, that is illogical, right? They clean public toilets quite often. Also, I shower. Sure, I do. Also, given I was building like a prison toilet seat with tissue paper and waste, killing trees for my own benefit pretty much every time I ever had to go to a toilet, I was probably covered, but it was completely disproportionate and feeling like I had to shower multiple times to get rid of it. So yeah, it was very anxiety provoking, very uncomfortable, and it felt quite shameful because I had to take all of those steps, and shameful because I felt conscious that I had other people's dirt on me. So it wasn't rational, and it was very tough.
One of the problems, though, about depression and anxiety is it is irrational sometimes.
Of course.
And my partner's a very rational person and struggles sometimes to understand the irrational nature of my thought process. Apparently, according to her, I catastrophize everything. I think that's an adorable trait in a human being. And that's for sure. And she's right. I go to, if someone says, what's the worst case scenario? I'll go there. And when someone says, what's the worst that can happen? That doesn't help me because it probably will happen.
Exactly. Yeah.
So don't tell me that because I know it'll happen.
Yes.
And it's quite difficult sometimes if people have never thought of these catastrophic end results. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how much I tell you. Don't be silly. Of course that's not going to happen. The irrational part of your mind takes over the rational part.
Yes, and I think I imagine you probably struggle as well because you're quite intelligent. And so the notion of someone saying to you, don't be silly, that's never going to happen, you could say, well, actually, plausibly it could. So you patronising me is both making this worse and more stressful.
And unfortunately, the history of my life is the worst often does happen. This is the problem.
Of course, you're Scottish, I know. I'm sorry.
It's true. The worst does often happen. That's the problem.
Of course it does.
So,
but you're not. But the thing is, I think that often how you think it's going to impact you is disproportionately.
Yes.
So the worst can happen and you can survive. Mm-hmm. And that's often part of it. So a big part of treatment for OCD that I did in cognitive behavioral therapy, CBD, is about doing the thing that you think is going to kill you, like going to a public toilet, not showering immediately after, and finding the world does not end. Maybe the OCD part of your brain's a liar.
I hate people telling me what to do, which is the problem. I've done cognitive behavioural therapy. That was the thing that worked best for me with my anxiety, mm-hmm. without question.
Because we're talkers and it's nothing to do. It doesn't want to hear you chat. No. It's just like, just do the thing.
Yes. And the problem was, I recently went back to therapy again because I needed to go back again because I just felt myself slipping back into yep. old behaviours. And that is one of the things. I wrote my book Cheer Up Love and then Sunny Side Up, which was about being more cheerful, and people go, oh well, you're fine now, and you go, no, I've always got it.
Interesting.
And recognising the fact that I was slipping back into those thought processes, mm-hmm. I thought I have to go back again to get some help with this because I felt myself slipping back in.
I think that's great though. I think that's great that you can say this is a consistent thing and that I will need help with it. I try to be pretty consistent with therapy, even when I feel like I don't need it, because I think it's certainly in my case with OCD, I can go, I'm actually doing really great, guys. I'm doing really great. And then, and anything with change or stress, which is effectively the life I have signed up for, you know, because it's so hard being a clown. Wah, wah, wah. It means I think I like to keep on top of it. But I do think that, I think particularly with depression, people want so earnestly for you to just be having a nice time, just to be like happy that they are kind of like, oh, you're fixed. Great. Okay, on to the next. And that doesn't tend to be, in my experience, how depression works. But I would say the inverse is true of OCD. In my case, at least, perhaps because I talk about it on stage and people want to ask questions, people are very unwilling to believe that I'm okay. Very unwilling. Like, as though, because it makes me more interesting if I'm not, right?
So yeah, yeah.
It's more interesting to go, what do you do mm-hmm. when you're crazy, than it is to go, how does that affect you? People, or like, it's more interesting for people to go, oh, Catherine's coming over, better tidy up. And let's be clear, I do wish they would. But like, to put that on me and be like, she's... And so I do think with OCD, people are unwilling to believe that you can get it to a place where it's under control. And that's not to say that it can't recur in times of stress or if you don't do the things that you should do. But you can certainly... I mean, I am very fortunate. I had a diagnosis. I was in a hospital. I had incredible doctors. I had an incredible therapist as soon as I came here. I have a partner who understands it. Medication's helped me massively. So actually, I am able to cope. I mean, I'm here. You just saw me go to the loo. I mean, you didn't watch me go to the loo.
No, I didn't.
But like,
I'd like to make it clear that I don't follow people to the toilet. One of the things that I always find interesting when I talk to comedians is there's this kind of conceit of the clown crying in the corner, we're all sad. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of us with kind of anxiety issues. It is the worst job in the world, in a way, for people with these issues, but also the best job in the world.
I agree.
So I actually started talking about my mental health more when I became a comedian than before I did. So yes, it's awful. I have control issues. Mm-hmm. I'm going places I don't know, with people I don't know, in situations I don't know, to towns I don't know, on trains I can't rely on. It is anxiety inducing. So it's the worst job, but it's the best job. How do you find it?
But also, I mean, I completely agree. Also, therapeutically, you're doing CBD in those cases, right?
Yes, I suppose you're challenging. Yeah, yeah.
You're challenging mm-hmm. the thought with the action. Okay.
Surprising how little money it takes for me to do that. 20 quid in Sheffield. Yes, yes, please. No problem.
Ah, Sheffield. Oh, boy. Yes, we've all been stuck there. Most recently, I got a taxi home from Leeds.
Did you?
Yes, I didn't. Thankfully, I mean, the rail network paid for it, and like, I was with 8 strangers, and they were all British and all livid, so nobody said a single thing for 5 hours. Yes, silence. Oh boy, it was stressful.
The silent fury of a taxi.
I was like, would
people.
Anyone like a sweet? And everyone was like, shush, we do not talk. Everyone open a window and call your wives. Like, just men like whispering into the wind lest they be heard complaining. Oh, terrifying. Yeah, you guys are, I mean, British people are weird when they're mad. But anyway, what was I saying? I don't really count Scottish people in that because I feel like you guys would have been more jovial in that situation.
I think having been in that kind of situation, I'm used to it. So I've got a suitcase that specifically it's behind you can be used as a seat.
Nice.
I always have a snack with me.
Yes, I'm big on snacks.
I've got a lot of podcasts.
Yeah.
I just hunker down and wait for it to be over.
Agreed.
You know?
Yeah. In answer to your question, I think stand-up comedy is the best job I could have possibly ended up in based on my mental illness because people, in a way, expect it of you. So it's not uncomfortable in the way that it is often to bring it up in corporate environments, which isn't to say that corporate environments aren't getting better, but people are like, yeah, sure, of course, you're a comedian. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to justify. Secondly, I make my own day a lot of the time. So if I'm having a bad morning, that's fine. I don't have to decide whether or not I can make it to work till 4 p.m. And most of the time I probably can because work, also because I love this job and I've never loved another job before, so I want to go to work. But I can make my day, I can plan my day a bit more. I'm in control of my diary a bit more. So I can also go, that's going to be too much for me. Like there's no way I'm going to be able to cope with that. And also I have a team around me. I'm really lucky. I don't know if this is true of all comics, but I have a team around me who believe me when I say I'm having a bad day, but also believe me when I say I'm having a good day. I'm fine. So that's really fortunate. But yeah, I do think you're right about the talking about it. I think last year's show I talked about, for Edinburgh, I talked about having OCD and got to do so on my own terms without interruption or question. And I also got to talk about being in hospital and I got to talk about my family's reaction to it. But I felt like I put loads of things to bed that maybe I wouldn't have ever put to bed if I didn't do this job, because I wouldn't have, why would I open that can of worms again? But actually it was really good for me to do that 8 years out of a diagnosis, where usually I would have just been like, well, let's never think of that again until the problem rears its ugly head. So I do agree. I think it's a good job for
it. I think it, I find the process of having to think about how to make something funny means you have to look at it more closely.
Agreed.
So how do I make this funny? I've got to really think about what I'm saying to see if I can make it funny. And in that way, you examine what it is. I've talked about things in stand-up that I haven't talked about, mm-hmm. but I feel comfortable in a room of 200 strangers saying it, mm-hmm. but I feel very uncomfortable face-to-face with a family member or a friend talking about it.
It's amazing, isn't it? I went to a preview of, this is going to reflect poorly on my relationship, I went to a preview of my girlfriend's show 2 weeks ago. And she said something that I knew about her, but she had never verbalized. She'd never articulated in the way that she expressed on stage. So I was really proud of her for being able to articulate it, and really stunned that she could articulate it in that context, in a hot room in Camden to 12 people who did not know it was going to be an Edinburgh preview. And so I found, and I love that about stand-up. I mean, I was crying beside a man called Fraser who works at her PR, who was like, do you know her? So it was awkward, sure, but it was good and I'm glad that it happened. And I think, more to the point, I think if you are of our kind of mental illness where everything is about control, or maybe I don't want to speak for you, where my kind, where everything's about control and the idea of being imperfect or flawed is shame-based, to have a job where it necessitates that you volunteer for failure has taught me so much about my capacity to be flawed and vulnerable and wrong. Because if you don't want to fail, then you're in the wrong job, right?
Absolutely. I'm consistent, always failing.
If you're not failing, then you should probably write some new material.
Yes, and I mean, 15 years after I started, something like that, I just had another thing turned down.
Of course.
And you go,
yep.
And it's constant. The amount of success we actually have is fairly limited in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It's mostly failure based.
But also,
God, why am I doing this?
I know, right? But my favourite thing about it is also that you can do the same material. You can go to Sheffield and smash, mm-hmm. and then you can go to Canterbury the next night, and they can hate
yes.
you. Not just your material, they hate you.
Yes.
Very specific about mm-hmm. that. And that's kind of amazing, because you go, oh, it's almost like I can't be for everyone and like I can't be perfect all of the time. On top of which, I quite like the fact that where my brain would usually have gone to quite a depressive place, and it's not that it doesn't, but when bad things happen now, more often than not, unless they're catastrophic, I can go, but is it funny? And could I use it? Which mm-hmm. it probably sounds a little bit sociopathic, but like, I think part of, I like that part of my brain goes, yeah, but in a week, will you think you can say this on stage? Because it makes it less, you go, well, okay, then maybe it's not all in vain.
One of the things I've done as I'm in my mid-40s now is I've embraced the sociopathic side of me.
Oh.
Because I do think it's there. Oh, I think in a way many stand-ups have it, in that we are extreme empaths,
yeah,
but we are also sociopaths. Because in a way, the hatred the audiences express or the failure makes me just go,
same.
But like in a really cold, brutal way, not in a angry way. I just sit there sometimes getting emails, just clicking on them going, okay, sure. Sure. And I've got a list of people. Mm-hmm. Do you have a list of people?
A list of enemies, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure I do. I mean, my new show is called Lemon after a woman who hated my show last year. She was wearing a lemon cardigan. It's not normal, Susan. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that's not appropriate behaviour.
Both of us think the same way. Therefore, there's more than one. So it is normal.
Yes,
in this
let's
room,
say that.
It's very normal. One of the other things, as well as being blessed, hashtag blessed,
oh, goodness,
with OCD.
Yes.
You are of a different type of sexuality than the hetero.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know how to say these things anymore.
So no, don't. That's fine. I'm bisexual.
Okay, great.
But I wouldn't be offended by anything.
Isn't
else.
It awful that an old laser like me is frightened to talk about sexuality?
It's weird.
Because
yeah.
I don't. I am so.
No, I know.
I never want to upset anybody.
I guess for
about
me,
anything.
It doesn't offend me if you call me pansexual, and it doesn't offend me if you call me a lesbian. I am both of those things and all of those things.
Okay.
People get very affronted when I show up sometimes and I say, because I'm gay, and then people go, bye. They'll correct me, and I'll go, yeah, you know I am. But like, within that, I'm also gay, right? Because I'm gay sometimes and I'm straight sometimes, that's bisexual, right? Like, which isn't to say that I'm one doesn't erase the other, sure, but people
get very upset. In my day, Catherine, because I am at least probably double your age,
I mean I'm 30 years old, so it's very sweet of you to say
right?
that, but thank you.
There was lesbians and gays,
sure,
right? And that's basically what we had.
Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic. And when I interviewed Bethany Black on last year's Mrs. Brightside, it was a superb conversation.
Yeah.
Because the discussion of sexuality often happens without the people whose sexuality that's being discussed.
Yes, it does.
Is there.
Yes.
It's usually, I hate to say it, a group of white straight men sitting talking about someone else's life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how I always felt when equal marriage was being discussed. It was a bunch of old white men talking about whether or not I had the right to do something.
Are they people?
You know.
Like we're people.
Yeah.
Are they people like we're people because we're the measure of people?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, my sexuality informs everything I do. Just now, specifically for one reason, and that is that people still have a problem with me.
Of course they do.
I often get these tweets and emails saying, why are you always talking about your wife? Why are you always going about being gay? And it's because people still have a problem.
Yeah.
If everything was fine and I was treated like just a human being.
It's because nobody's tweeting Michael McIntyre to go, we get it. You have a wife. We get it. You have children. You're allowed to have children. Like, that's why it's a problem. Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course.
And it's such a strange thing because I was so political when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm not political now, but it felt angry because I grew up in Section 28, Clause 20, and we were angry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone told us it was all fine.
Mm-hmm.
And these days it just seems to be more important. And that's why I say I am more gay than people would think. The perception of me is I'm that nice lady from the television.
Mm-hmm.
And I am.
Yep.
But I'm also gay, and it's so important to me. How does it inform what you do?
Yes, I agree. I am. Here's the thing we have in common. I'm very quick to cry, Susan. Yeah, it's so important. Of course it is. It is. I mean, I'm trying to talk about this in my show in a way that is articulate and coherent, but I pass a lot of the time, for want of a better word. I look like a girl and I have long hair and I look like I have a nice boyfriend by absurd standards of heteronormativity.
Which is still in 2019 in force.
Of course.
It's ridiculous. Still in force, the idea of what a lesbian exactly. or a gay woman or whatever would look like.
Of course. My girlfriend does not pass. My girlfriend has short hair. Now, my girlfriend's also lighter, smaller than I am, but she gets more aggression and more violence on the streets than I do, which isn't to say that I'm exempt. Oh, if we're together, you better believe someone has something to say about it, mm-hmm. which is also why it's still an issue. But I think that I feel they're in some sort of duty to be like, yes, I pass. Yes, I'm a palatable version of lesbianism to you because I fit with some sort of ubiquitous notion of lesbians from porn that you have idealized us as, but I'm real queer, mm-hmm. and I am trying to. I think it's more as important, if not more, so important to go. It still matters, and absolutely, we have been given rights that everybody else had. Whoop-de-doo, and I'm not. I don't know. I don't mean to diminish that because they were hard fought and hard won, but. That doesn't mean that it's done or that people are okay with it and that we don't have, we don't have to still keep fighting for our space in the world. Mm-hmm. I don't need to hammer it too much, but like, you know, 2 weeks ago, two women were beaten up on a bus because they weren't performing homosexuality for the boys on that bus, and I just don't tell me it's okay because it's not okay.
It was terrible because I was at a book festival talking about my second book, Sunny Side Up, which is about positivity, and I couldn't that night because I'd seen that photograph and the person interviewing me said, "So Susan, how do you keep cheerful?" And I was just like, I can't do it tonight. I can't mm-hmm. do it tonight because that photograph. Was horrific. Mm-hmm. Was horrific to see, and you know it just come off the back of a few politicians once again talking about whether or not children should be taught that we exist. Mm-hmm. And I always say we're not suggesting that children should watch porn.
No,
not suggesting that children.
I would actually suggest. They shouldn't.
Yes, it's not about
big callers.
It's not about suggesting that this. It's about. It's not. But what people constantly. I think mistake homosexuality for sex. Mm-hmm. They always think that every gay person is constantly fucking. And all we're doing is discussing whose turn it is to take the bins down. I mean, that really is all that's happening in my house.
I completely agree. And it's the person with the shortest hair. Now, here's the thing. Because that's science. And yeah, most of the time we are just arguing about the bins mm-hmm. or whose white T-shirt it is that they're wearing, or you know, like it's not exactly weird. And but also, even if we are fucking, you don't get to call us disgusting. Like that's the thing that bothers me with Love is Love, because love is love, but also fucking is fucking, mm-hmm. and casual hookups are casual hookups, and people are people, and we don't have to be politely heteronormative for you to process us as worthy of dignity.
It's a really interesting discussion about the heteronormative thing that's happening sometimes mm-hmm. in terms of the LGBTQ plus community. Mm-hmm. But I always found it quite interesting that the embarrassment people felt when talking about even coming out was that what you're having to do at that point, which straight people don't ever have to do, is talk to your parents about the fact you have sex.
Mm-hmm. And what straight, kind and who you want to have sex with.
Straight people never have to, if they don't want to, ever discuss with their parents the fact that they are having sex or may have sex. Yep. Whereas you have to sit and go, I am now telling you. Mm-hmm. something about my life which I really don't mm-hmm. want to tell you about. Mm-hmm. I was lucky in that I grew up in a family that never talked about anything.
Which is so fortunate and definitely has nothing to do with your mental illness. Nothing at all. Congratulations, Susan.
When my dad read my book, The Cheer Up Love, which is really detailed about, you know, depression and stuff.
He read your book, though.
And I said, what did you think, Dad? He went, yep, very good. And I was like, right, okay, great. So I'm glad we're still not going into any of
but
the
issues. But that is a glowing review.
Look,
right?
I'm fine. I don't want to talk about anything
I
with
completely
my family,
relate to this.
Ever.
My parents came to my Soho show. They came to see my show last year, entirely about my dad and our relationship and my mental health and expressing that and my sexuality to them. And they had a really nice time and think Soho Theatre is lovely. And to be fair, the bartender, because my dad's a Catholic deacon, and my dad just loves to shake hands and kiss babies, and so the bartender made a big fuss over him and booked them a booth for afterwards. By the way, I was a week at Soho. This never happened another night. And my dad, we get into the taxi, and my dad is shaking hands with everyone in the smoking area. So he is that kind of guy who, like, he would be like, great night, great night had by all, but we didn't talk about the show. We just said, what a wonderful place. And we all moved on. And that's okay. Because
that's fine. It's fine. It's fine.
Because they came and because he read your book.
Yes, absolutely. He read my book, and that's all fine. And we never need to talk about it again. And they've never seen anything I've done, and they never need to see anything I've done. They've never seen me do stand up, and I never want them to see them that. No. Never.
Wow.
They only came to Strictly because it turns out OAPs can book their own train tickets.
We have got to stop letting them do things.
And she said, my mum said, and we're just coming anyway, Susan. So they just came.
I thought they were so proud of
you. Oh, they were so proud. But at the same time, I feel so nervous around that they're there watching what I'm doing.
I am fairly sure my parents think it's, I think they're confused as to how I have a stand-up career, because they've seen me four times, and I'll be honest, I've been pretty bad every time because I'm so nervous in front of them.
Yeah.
And I think they must go home and go, well, I mean, it's not... So I wouldn't have thought she's... I mean, I guess some people just like anxious women. Like, what? Like, yeah, because I've just been completely fine.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Your religion when you were growing up was?
Catholic.
I'm going to tell you a story that I've never said out loud.
I love that you're revealing so much.
I know, I just feel comfortable with
Go
you.
Go on.
And I just feel it's appropriate.
We're not going to talk about our parents, so tell me.
I once went out with a lady, this is a long time ago, from Belfast.
Yes.
She was of the Catholic religion. Mm-hmm. And she said to me at one point, I feel there's always three people in the bedroom, you, me and Jesus. No.
Is he looking away? I hope he's looking away.
It didn't last long, the relationship.
Oh, I thought you meant in the bedroom.
I was brought up, I don't go to church anymore. I'm fine with people's religion. It's just not for me. I was brought up Protestant.
Now you sound like a homophobe. I'm fine with it. It's just not for me.
No.
It's not how I was raised.
I absolutely respect people having a religious belief.
Of course.
Personally speaking, I have experienced so much negativity from a lot of religion that it's not so. But I was brought up Protestant. Now, the Church of Scotland are very easy-ozy about things. Mm. I was never taught as part of my religion that homosexual... I mean, it wasn't, you weren't encouraged. But
it was inferred,
but
sure.
But I didn't have any huge pressure. Friends of mine from different religions, however, have a very different story sometimes. How did it affect you when you thought you might have been, one of us?
So I should say that I was raised in a very liberal home, and my dad is very religious, but in a very socialist manner. So he thinks that religion is a function to, like, redistribute both hope and wealth, and thinks that it is your duty to help other people. My mother is very much like, she loves sex. She loves gay people. If anything, too much. When I came out, she was like, I mean, please, aren't we all? And I was like, no, we're not all. What are you talking about? And so religious, yes, but not judgmental, and very much they don't see inclusion as at odds with religion. If anything, they think it's the duty of people of faith to be inclusive, right? Because they're very like Catholic in the sense that they follow Jesus' example. So they,
which is what it should be.
I concur, but not yes. So that I would say I always grew up in a very liberal home. My education was much more religious than my home life. I went to an all-girls Catholic school in a convent, and I thought I was gay because I was only around women. So, well, yeah, so I thought I was gay, and it was only when I got to university that I was like, oh, okay. I mean, I don't mind.
Yeah.
But, and I did not say anything to anyone about it because I was hyper aware that that would not be okay. Not only that that would be something that I would probably be told to stop saying by the teachers in my school, but also, like, I had a business teacher, a business school, like, he did business studies, and he would openly make homophobic jokes, and it was just not, it was not something that was entertained, discussed in any possible way. Although I did have an incredible English teacher who was my debate coach as well, and he talked about everything and anything, and I think he might have saved me from an awful lot of bad thoughts in school. But so it was, but I was aware, I mean, I was very aware that it was not okay, and that my, and I think what I found most unjust was, and what I still find difficult with religion, is that I don't believe in God, and I don't have faith, but it upsets me that so many people I know who are gay, who have faith, can't get married in front of their families in the churches that they care about. That upsets me greatly. I find it hard to go to church weddings. I find it weird. I find it hard to go to marriages, weddings in places that would not let us get married. I find that uncomfortable. I think I always think it's weird when I'm invited to them in a way, because I go, you know, I'm not allowed to do that, right? You don't have any objection.
Last time I went to a church for someone's ruby wedding, and my wife and I were sitting thinking, is this a trap?
Yeah.
You know, when you're sitting, when I'm sitting in a church.
Yeah, I'm going to set on fire.
Especially some churches. We went to a great wedding once in a church in Scotland, and the minister got up and started shouting, marriage is for the procreation of children.
No, he didn't.
And Lee and I were just like, oh God, this is it. This is it.
Oh,
this
my
is just,
gosh.
It's like the Wicker Man. We're going to be burned to death. Yeah.
What?
And you just, you think, whoa. And it's not that I really don't necessarily, I don't have a problem with people's beliefs. I'm a spiritual woman. Mm. I think it's just looking for an excuse. Another, it seems like in life there's always an excuse for us not to be, it's normal's not the correct word, not to be allowed to live our lives. Mm-hmm. Whether it's political or social or moral, that morally we're wrong, that legally we're wrong, that whatever it is. And it just seems like there's always an excuse for someone to do something to us.
Well, people revel in righteousness, right? And you can't be right unless somebody else is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And life can be hard, and it feels better somehow if by comparison you're beating somebody else or you're not. Like, I think it makes me sad. But I would also say that I have been fortunate that the people who are religious in my life also just don't think that I was a mistake.
Yeah.
I don't think they think their creator makes those, which I am very fortunate to be in a position to say.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's also, I mean, it's remarkable to me that religions are still hammering the anti-gay drum in, certainly in a lot of countries where gay rights are legal, because I'm like, dudes, you are really losing followers. Mm-hmm. Like, think of the people you could get on board if you seemed a little progressive.
My point is always this. You want me as your neighbour. You shouldn't be frightened of having two lesbians living next door to you. We are brilliant.
Agreed.
We take care of our house. We'll take your bins down for you. In fact, there's a fight for it. You want us.
Yeah.
I keep a notebook with everyone's number plates that come into the street in case there's a robbery.
Oh my God, you are a psychopath. We're just going to find this list of people who've travelled into your area being like, the lesbian killed them.
They're going to thank me.
You'll all be glad I kept your registration.
And do you know what? Do you know what? This is absolutely true. In the local paper recently, my area is the lowest crime area in Glasgow.
And you think that's
Why
because
is
of
that?
You?
It's because of me. Because I'm Batman.
Oh my god, we need a lesbian Batman.
Well, don't.
Okay, sorry.
Don't, because they've made Batgirl with that Ruby Rose.
They have. Are you okay?
No.
No? Did you think that should be you?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, and why is that?
Well, okay, so it's got to be someone who... Okay, here's my theory about assassins as well, right?
Please.
Okay, so Angelina Jolie as an assassin is absolutely fucking ridiculous. Why?
Yes, you're going to notice her.
Angelina Jolie walks in here and you go, oh, I've just seen a beautiful woman.
Yeah.
Who are you not going to notice? Me, dressed as the lady that collects the sanitary towel bin. Right? You're not going to notice that woman, are you? You're not even going to see her. When's the last time you noticed?
I would look away if somebody was changing the sanitary bin. I would. I'm a bad person.
Time?
You're right.
When is the last time you went, oh, I've clocked her collecting that bin?
You're right.
So, Batgirl woman, right, should be someone... You notice when Ruby Rose walks into a bloody room.
You do, to be fair.
Right?
You do.
Me,
all those
wouldn't pay attention. Quickly change into my costume.
And you do your own sound effects. I bet you they have to pay a sound guy and Ruby Rose.
And I would be there. Low centre of gravity means that I'm amazing at fighting. And I just think it's wrong. I think it's wrong that yet again I've been overlooked.
Listen,
I felt the same way at Doctor Who, but we won't go into that right now because it gets me very angry that I wasn't even considered for Doctor Who.
I'll be honest with you. When you brought it up, I thought, this is going to be mad. But actually, you make a good case and it's outrageous. I'd sign that petition.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, if people can...
Can I just ask you a question? Mm-hmm. I know it's really bad. No, actually, that's...
No, tell me. No,
I was going to say something objectifying.
Uh-huh.
Who's hotter, Ruby Rose or Angelina Jolie, in your opinion?
Angelina Jolie.
Interesting. Oh, we have a different type. Okay.
I think, and I know she listens to this podcast, so sorry, Ruby. Mm. I think she's a bit full of herself.
I kind of love that in
a
woman.
I don't like that in a woman.
I do.
I don't like that.
I
like a woman to be confident, don't get me wrong.
Interesting.
But I don't like it if... I don't like it if I think that the person I'm with will spend more time looking at themselves than me.
I mean, we'd have common interest, I suppose. My feeling is I like to break down the person I'm with, so I want them to be left still standing. You know, like, I don't want them to be like a drivelling wreck. Like, my girlfriend was very cocky when I met her, and now she's appropriately behaved, I would say. And I think that's like, I like that. And I mean, saying that, do you remember when Angelina Jolie used to date the Calvin Klein model? What was her name? Oh, that's going to annoy me so much.
Oh, the one that was
beautiful
in,
Asian.
She wasn't in G. I know the one you mean.
God. Yes. I mean, that was a great time too.
But
so
again,
I don't want to.
Again, so.
The other day, I can't think of her name.
The other day, I took my bra off and there was biscuits in my bra.
Oh my god!
Because I had a biscuit.
How cooked was your top? I can't imagine. How did it get under your round neck t-shirt?
I was wearing a V-neck t-shirt and I was having some short bread.
Oh, okay, it was a V-neck. Fair enough.
Right, I was having some short bread as I was working.
Yeah.
And then take your bra off at the end of the night, biscuit.
I mean, I
don't want the woman I'm in bed with to go as I then eat the bits of biscuit. I want them to go,
yeah, but that's why you
adorable.
Take your bra off in the loo, okay? You take your bra off in the loo. It's fine.
Bra off in the loo.
Eat the biscuit. You head on in there to Angelina. What shall she think other than that you taste of biscuits? Great times.
She would not be happy with
that's
me.
That's not a problem I have because between my girlfriend and I, neither of us really has boobs. If we squish them all together and make one good boob.
Just one big boob.
If you think a good boob has four nipples, I suppose. Yeah. Anyway, that's too much information.
No, listen, it's absolutely fine. That'll be the trailer for this episode.
Stop sexualizing lesbians. Also, if you could imagine my boobs and my girlfriend's boobs.
I know. I wanted to talk to you about the crying thing.
Yes.
I really struggle not to cry. And my wife said to me the other day, I didn't want to talk to you about that because you'd start crying. And I said, but I'll cry anyway. So otherwise we'll never talk.
Yeah.
I mean, I cry about everything. And my therapist said to me, do you want to stop crying? Do you want us to work on you not crying? Mm. And I think, I don't know if I do or not. It does get in the way.
I mean, Sarah cries at, I mean, I thought I cried a lot and then I started doing, she cries at everything. And I think it's her only way of processing. So I don't think I'd want her to stop doing that. I cry quite a lot, but not at things that I want to cry at. So when something terrible happens, I can't cry. And when you talk to me about gay rights, the history of which
I've heard before, Susan. Like, I am like, God, Lord, it's all so sad. And so, like, yeah, I think if it's a way you process, then why would you want to stop it?
I think I cry when I feel deep emotion, whether it's anger or fear or it's like my brain switches into. So I'll cry when Andy Murray plays tennis.
Oh, of course.
Because he's my future husband.
Oh my God, same. That's so weird that we're going to be sister wives.
He's the only man I would ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think marriage-wise, I think he's one of the few who have potential.
Yeah. I met his mother and said, would you like me to be your daughter-in-law? And she didn't answer the question, which I thought was quite rude from Judy.
That's a bit rude.
I thought it was a bit rude, actually, because who wouldn't want me?
I agree. You can dance.
I can dance.
And you're Scottish. What more does she want?
I know. She's so picky. Oh but I find it that people think it's a sign of weakness in me. That's the only reason I don't like it, is that people then think I'm an over-emotional woman. Do you know what I mean? And that is a tag negative.
But do you think that's... Do you think women are weak when they cry?
No.
And do you think the concept of women as overly emotional by virtue of their capacity to feel is misogynist?
No. I think people, when you feel things deeply, it's a very positive thing. I think me being empathetic is a very positive thing. Other people don't know how to deal. I was once on a Virgin train to Glasgow weeping for about 4 hours.
Sure, that's what public transport's for.
And just nobody looked at me at all.
Were you in Britain?
Yes, I was
travelling.
Well,
then there's your problem. I mean, I've never been on a plane I haven't cried on. I genuinely, planes are for crying and sleeping, as far as I can understand them. I don't think that, I think that, like, if you'd said, I want to stop for this reason, I would think, sure. But if it's purely based on other people's reaction, I think that's predominantly a misogynist view, that women are weak because they cry. And I actually think if more men cried, the world would be a healthier place. But also, I don't know. For all the people that think, oh, I don't know how to deal with this, I think, like, watching you on Strictly, I think there were a whole bunch of people who went, oh, thank God, somebody who processes and feels the way I do. Like, every time you cried, I cried. Mm-hmm. Just because you were crying. Mm-hmm. I have a friend, Georgie, and we pretty much, if one cries, the other cries. Mm-hmm. Because I can't watch her cry. And she can't watch me cry. And so... I know. I think that you will have resonated with more people than you think when you did that.
There was a lovely story, and I asked people for acts of kindness in my last book, and there's a beautiful one because I think it illustrates how people can't cope with people crying. A woman said she was in a cafe and she was crying, and a man handed her a balloon penguin because the guy's obviously been going, I don't know what to do. I'll make her a balloon penguin, and just gave her a balloon, and it worked.
That's
but
so
I loved
lovely.
That as someone just unable to know what to do, so made a balloon penguin, and I think that's the right. And if I'd been given one, I would have stopped crying.
Yeah.
I suspect
that's really lovely.
Before we finish off, because we have to finish off, we've been told we have to keep the podcast to like 55 minutes. Personally, I like a podcast that goes on beyond that.
Because you love a 3-hour podcast.
Oh, I love see for this one that's an hour and 15 minutes. I go, yes.
Do you?
If one's 25, I'm not happy.
Yeah, I feel that way about podcasts I like, but I do not feel that way about podcasts friends have said they're on and that I should listen to.
Really?
Yeah, so it depends, doesn't it? You're like, if your mom's like, you've got to listen to this episode, and then you go, it's so long.
My mother phones me on a Monday to review her weekend television viewing, and it matches not a jot if I've seen the programme or not. She talked to me at length about Murder in Paradise, which I've never seen, because they changed a character. 55 minutes later, I still haven't seen it, Mother, but carry on
That's
talking.
That's so great. My mum calls me when she wants me to watch something, but then tells me everything that happened, including the spoilers. And so then I go, well, now there's no point in me watching it. And she says, every time. Like, she can't like, believe.
Oh, did I say something I shouldn't have?
But I just thought you'd want to know what it was about. Yeah, maybe I don't need to know everybody's full storyline, though.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
What I always like to finish with is... Not one of those, if you could tell yourself when you were 14 what you should have done, but just what you've learned. For if people are listening and thinking, that resonates with me, I get that. Just advice to yourself, people, what's your final say on all of this?
Tell more than one person that you need help, or be willing to tell more than one person that you need help, because... the first person might not believe you, and you might, or they might have just been closest to you, so you told them, and they're not the best person to tell.
Very important to find the right person. This is very important. What you're essentially doing is handing someone a puppy and saying, look after this.
Yes.
And some people don't want to look after a puppy, do they?
Yes. And also, more often than not, the right person is a professional. As much as somebody loves you, usually it's better to go speak to a GP. And if your GP is not responding the way you feel they need to, speak to another GP. Or, you know, I think that's the one thing that for me is, aside from the fact that it's not necessarily fair to put it on one person, I think that often the first person you tell is not the best person to tell. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But I think getting to a place where I could get professional help was the best thing that ever happened to me. And as much as anybody around me loved me and could tell me all I wanted, that everything would be fine if they made my bed instead of me one day, I wasn't living. I was alive, but I don't think I was living until I got proper help. And I would say the other thing, and I think it's the same culture that says, oh, nobody look at that woman who's crying on the train, says, oh, she's a bit dramatic. Isn't she? She's a bit dramatic. I have spent so much of my life, I think till I was 25, feeling like I was so dramatic. Catherine's the dramatic one. Mm-hmm. What an overreaction. And it's like, no, like I had a proper illness. I was very deeply unhappy and unwell. And it wasn't dramatic to go to hospital. It was massively necessary.
Yep.
And so, I don't know if that's the answer to your question.
No, it is the answer to the question. It absolutely is the answer to the question. Because what I always say to people is, I think the most important thing is go to your GP, and if you don't think your GP is listening to you, find another GP to listen to. Because they're not all great at listening to people talking about mental health. They're also working under great time constraints.
They're human.
Find someone else. The other thing is, people always ask me, oh, it's so much better now everyone's talking about mental health. And the answer is not really. Because if you're going to the NHS specifically, you have to wait a while for a counselling appointment. Mm. So this is it can sometimes be a battle.
Yep.
But I think if you take the first step to go to the GP, it's the most important and difficult thing to do, is to go and admit to somebody that you need help.
I agree.
And it is the most important thing.
And it's horrible that might require having to do that a couple of times with a couple of people. But you can, if you've done it once, you can do it.
Catherine, it's been a delight. And if people want to find out more information about what you're doing, apart from befriending you,
where
can they find out?
Well, I have a website, katherinebohart.com, or on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. I'm all of those places. And I'm, if anything, too keen with talking about my shows online. My mother says, gosh, you have an awful lot of tickets to sell. That's not what you asked. Yes, katherinebohart.com, and I am on tour, and I'll be all over the UK and Ireland if people want to come see me. I would love that.
Will you tweet when your parents are going to see you again? Because I think we'd all like to go at the performance with your mum and dad.
Yeah, I mean, they'll have a booth probably, because the bartender still asks me, the same guy in Soho asks me about my parents every time, because they were a hit. And my show was fine, but they were a hit. I will, of course, tweet when they are in. They'll be only too delighted to meet and greet afterwards, I'm sure.
I'm looking forward to it. We'll all line up. Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Mrs. Brightside. If you like the show, why not subscribe? We're available everywhere you can download podcasts. And if you've already subscribed, why not tell a friend? Next week, I'll be talking to
Darren Harriott.
I find it weird when I see comics who are just like, oh, killed it.
Yeah.
Like, how was the gig? Smashed it. Destroyed. I'm always more like, yeah, they were generous. Like, they were fun. They were nice.
Yeah. Susan Kalman's Mrs. Brightside is hosted, appropriately enough, by me, Susan Kalman. The producer is Benjamin Sutton and is a BBC Studios production for Acast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.